Our reading this morning is a compilation of excerpts from a long poem by the great 19th century poet Walt Whitman called A Song of Occupations. It is an ode to the American working people of his time and of our time, no less. For I am sure that most of us gathered here are or were, before we retired, working people. People who add value to society through our labors in the home or in employment, whether in the form of products or services. Whitman is praising our worth and value, empowering us to own our democracy and to find expressed in ourselves the beauty of all of the arts. In the full text, here is what he says about music. All music is what awakes from you when you are reminded by the instruments. It is not the violins and the cornets. It is not the oboe nor the beating drums, nor the score of the baritone singer singing his sweet romanza, nor that of the men's chorus or the women's chorus. It is nearer and farther. And this is the full text of what he says about government, timely in this primary season. The sum of all known reverence I add up in you, whoever you are. The president is there in the White House for you. It is not you who are here for him or her. The secretaries act in their bureaus for you, not you here for them. The Congress convenes every 12th month for you. Laws, courts, the forming of states, the charters of cities, the going and coming of commerce and malls are all for you. But why I chose this piece by Walt Whitman as the reading this morning has little to do with the arts or with government, just as why I chose the opening hymn has little to do with worshiping the divine, even though it suggested images of the divine, strong mother, warm father, old, aching, young, eager God. The reading and the hymn were chosen because of something to be sensed more than heard directly in them, that we each are empowered if we would but hear the invitation to find in our own lives our own stories of meaning and our own images for the sacred. Remember Whitman saying, we consider Bibles and religions divine, but it is not they who give the life, it is you who give the life. And remember at the close of the hymn, great living God, never fully known. We give the life to any myths and stories that have any meaning to us, whether they are the myths of religion or literature or the stories of our own lives. The very nature of what is meant by the word God is that it is never fully known. It is ineffable, beyond our seeing, closer yet than breathing. Again, we are the meaning makers for what is most ultimate for us, or what theologians call the ground of our being, or what perhaps you experience in high moments of profound awe and wonder, whether you call it simply amazing or give it a name, like God or the goddess, the spirit of life, the light of love. We make our own meanings, divine and otherwise, mainly through stories. Oh, the stories we tell. One of our country's best known story collectors is probably Paul Auster, who is himself a storyteller of renown, author of 14 novels, 4 screenplays, and the delightful, mysterious short fable, Auggie Wren's Christmas Story. If you don't know it, it is a great read aloud for your congregation or family next Christmas gathering. Auster well known as a story collector for his role in hosting National Public Radio's National Story Project some years ago. You may have heard some of those stories on the radio. 4,000 stories came in that year from everyday Americans, and he read them all. Too many to air on the radio, he edited an anthology of 179 of the best of them. He called it, "I Thought My Father Was God," after one of the stories. In that story, a boy's father shouts at the mean old man next door to drop dead, and to the boy's horror and amazement, the man does just that. So that's why he thought his father was God. In the book's introduction, Auster wrote, "We all have inner lives. We all feel that we are part of the world and yet exiled from it. We all burn the fires of our own existence. Words are needed to express what is in us. What the people have said is often astonishing. More than ever, I have come to appreciate how deeply and passionately most of us live. Our attachments are ferocious. Our loves overwhelm us, define us, and obliterate the boundaries between ourselves and others." Years earlier, in his novel, The Locked Room, Auster wrote, "Stories happen to people who are able to tell them." And I'd like to tell you my best story to date. It happened in April of 2004. The state trooper said it was the weirdest accident he had ever come across, and he hadn't even seen it happen, but I did. It was a rainy Tuesday morning, and I was on my way to work. I'd just driven around Cloverleaf from Route 2 getting onto Route 128, I-95, and was already in the middle lane. Suddenly, but as if in slow motion, a driver's side door of the SUV ahead of me opened, and something fell out. Was it a sweater? No, it was a person, small and slight, a woman. Amazingly, she curled her body, protected her head with her arms, and nearly bounced on the highway, maybe twice, and then she was on her feet, facing the traffic. Her SUV kept going straight ahead. Fortunately, I was able to pull over onto the side of the highway. Other vehicles swerved left or right to avoid her. An 18-wheeler came to a stop in her lane just one length away from her. Perhaps she's an equestrian, I thought, because she knew how to fall so gracefully. By then, I was out of my car. I called to the woman, and she came over, able to walk on her own. She didn't look at all upset. Maybe a little pale. For a rainy day, she wasn't wearing much, jeans and a navy hoodie, partially zipped, I remember. Well, I invited her to sit in the passenger seat of my minivan. She seemed dazed, but not that dazed, considering just what she went through, falling out of a moving vehicle on the interstate. "You were lucky you weren't hit," I said. She nodded. When I asked, she knew her name, and it was Diane. "That's my name, too," I said. The coincidence did not impress her. "What happened?" I asked her. "My door wasn't fully shut, and I leaned on it. That's when I fell out." "Were you alone?" I asked. She nodded, "Yes." "Where's my car? Can you take me to my car? I have to get my purse. My purse is in my car," she said. I'm thinking, honey, I'm not taking you anywhere. We're waiting for the police to come. I told her, "Your car drove off without you. I'm sure it's crashed by now." And in that place on the highway, there was a slight rise, so we couldn't see her vehicle, but we could see all the traffic had slowed down. Meantime, another car had pulled over, and I saw that man was out on the side of the road talking on a cell phone, or I presume he was calling the police. And eventually, he came over and let her use his cell phone to call whomever she wished. And we conferred, and I told him her story. He agreed. It didn't seem very likely. We agreed that if it had been true, she would have grabbed onto the steering wheel and would have caused her SUV to swerve before she fell out. Suicide, we wondered, or was she shoved at? Meanwhile, she was calling her mother and her husband, and I was amazed to realize that she could remember their phone numbers, despite what she had been through. Soon, the emergency vehicles came. EMTs checked her out in the front of my car, abrasions, but no broken bones. But to be cautious, they put her on a stretcher and put her in the ambulance and drove off. I was really surprised that nobody wanted to hear my story. So I went up to the state trooper and offered it. He too expressed disbelief at the woman's explanation. He took my name and phone number, and he told me that the first 911 call that they had received was a report that there was a driverless car in the highway. And then a few seconds later, another call came in telling them that there was a woman standing in the highway. Well, I, as you can imagine, was all shook up on the way to work. Got some relief from telling our office administrator immediately and my family later that night. The next day, the state trooper called to ask me a few questions. Then he told me that the SUV had rolled off the highway without hitting anything or anyone, miraculously. He said he went to where it was towed to try out her explanation. He sat in the driver's seat and kind of closed the door, but not fully, and tried to lean over, but the distance was way too great for that to have happened accidentally. Suicide, he wondered. I don't know, I mused. Haven't you ever been somewhere like the top of a mountain and had a sudden impulse to step off just to see what might happen? I know what you mean, he interrupted. And then there was a silence between us. She wondered what would happen to a person who fell out of a car going 60 miles per hour. The difference is she followed through. That was the weirdest accident I've ever come across, said the state trooper, and he ended our conversation. What makes it even weirder for me, I said, was that she has the same name as I do. Yeah, but she spells it differently, he said, matter of fact. We said goodbye and hung up, and in the mystery of it all, I felt very glad. Toward the end of his memoir, Now and Then, Reverend Friedrich Buechner says, listen to your life. See for it the fathomless mystery that it is, in the boredom and pain of it, no less than in the excitement and gladness. Touch, taste, smell your way to the holy and hidden part of it, because in the last analysis, all moments are key moments. And life is grace. For a while, that story was for me just that, a great story, and it was fun to tell. It might have been a candidate for the story project if it hadn't already been over. But then I began to wonder what meaning it might have for me. And first I thought, why me? Why was I the one to be following her as she fell out of her car? I had been given an opportunity to serve, but like so many people in emergency situations, I did not think about whether I would or not. I just acted. And in retrospect, the event resonated with and reinforced somehow my sense of calling to ministry, a sense sense of having been chosen. And in case I wouldn't notice, fate gave her my name, albeit spelled differently. Two, I took story as a spiritual lesson, a lesson in paying attention. Had I been changing the radio station or using my cell phone or even just been lost in thought, planning my day or whatever, I might not have seen something fall out of the car up ahead of me in time to wonder what it was, and therefore having time to avoid hitting the woman it turned out to be. We miss so much in life, so much beauty, serendipity, and opportunities to touch each other's hearts because we're not giving life our full attention. I know that, we all know that, but this story shouted at me, pay attention. Most of all, perhaps, it had meaning for me as a story, a true story of amazing grace. Grace happens. No one hit her. No one was hit by her driverless car. She was so graceful with her falling. But it was also a somber and unsettling story, profoundly so. That other Diane was either in such despair, or she thought so little of life that she would risk losing her life and put others in danger of losing theirs too. What was she thinking? More to the point, perhaps, what was she feeling? True, she fell gracefully and experienced grace in surviving, but she was also graceless, which the dictionary defines as lacking in any sense of what is right. Ultimately, the meaning of the story is still a mystery to me. Listen to your life, Peter said. See it for the fathomless mystery that it is. Sometimes in our day-to-day lives, in the boredom and in the pain of it, we don't see the mystery. We only see the problems. We may allow negative stories to dominate our thoughts. We allow repetitive negative themes to repeat themselves in stories of resentment. We may rehearse our hurts, the debts owed to us, the debts owed us, and the trespasses against us over and over again. These stories wear a track in our minds and our thoughts like cross-country skiers ski in the same track, repeating and retracing these negative thoughts. That happens to me sometimes. Maybe it happens to you. And congregations may get caught up in telling negative stories too. A prominent consultant to congregations writes, one of the primary kinds of stories that takes hold in congregations and makes change difficult is what is known as the problem-saturated story, or one in which the focus is on who or what is or has been wrong. And he says that such a story can have a trance-like effect and be self-reinforcing sometimes. The storytellers see only those things that reinforce the story, and what is contradictory to it is not seen. These kinds of stories, he says, have the impact of being taken as fact rather than as a narrative created by a particular sifting of the facts. Sometimes that happens in parish life when business, church business, is discussed in unrepresentative gatherings in the parking lot or over lunch. When we are hearing this kind of problem-saturated story, it can be helpful to say, what would someone who disagrees with your version of events say? Or tell me about times when this problem is not present. These questions may allow people to stand outside of that negative story and see the congregation from a different perspective, often revealing different actions that are available and different results that may be possible. A different story may make change possible. A similar release is available to us as individuals. The Buddhist teacher, Jodi teaches her students how not to bite the hook of anger, resentment, and other destructive emotions. She introduces us to the Tibetan word shenpa, which is translated as the charge behind our likes and dislikes and opinions. It is that charge that hooks us into them, making them so hard to get rid of, and gives our tone of voice such a mean edge sometimes when we express ourselves. In one of her talks, she says, here is an everyday example of shenpa. Someone says a mean word to you, and then something in you tightens. That's the shenpa. Then it starts to spiral into low self-esteem, or blaming them, or anger at them, or denigrating yourself. Maybe if you have a strong addiction to low self-esteem, blaming, anger, or self-denigration, you just go right for your addiction to cover over the bad feeling that arose when that person said that mean word to you. This is a mean word that gets to you, it hooks you. Another mean word may not affect you, but we're talking, she says here, about where it touches that sore place in you. That's a shenpa. But we have a choice, she says. It is possible to get out of shenpa. It is possible to step off the track of our negative personal thoughts, as it is possible to tell a congregation's story even-handedly. Again, we give the life to any myths and stories that have any meaning to us, whether they are the myths, religion, or literature, or the stories of our own lives, personal and congregational. Within truth's limits, we can choose our own stories. Pema Chodron says that the first step to being released from a shenpa is simply to recognize it. Then you refrain from giving into it. That's when the practice really gets interesting, she says. What do you do when you don't do the habitual thing? You're kind of left with that urge or charge much more in your face. And instead of reacting in your usual way, you try to relax into it. So she proposes four R's: recognizing, refraining, which simply means not going down that shenpa road, relaxing into the underlying feeling of being pumped, and then something called resolve, which means you do this over and over and over again. Chodron counsels us, it's not an overnight miracle that you just undo that habituation. It takes a lot of loving kindness, a lot of recognition with warmth toward ourselves. It takes a lot of learning how to not go down that path, learning how to refrain, and it takes a lot of willingness to stay present. And you do it over and over and over. In the process, you learn so much humility, it softens you up just enormously. Humility is not self-denigration, of course. Instead, she says, it humbles you in the best sense and also begins to give you a lot of confidence in your own wisdom, in your Buddha nature, in your basic goodness. And it begins to be more and more activated. And you, from your own wisdom, begin to go more towards spaciousness and openness and unhabituatedness. But it doesn't happen quickly. Such patience with and love toward ourselves is required for this kind of change. Changing habits and choosing new stories, whether personal, in our relationships, in our congregations, in our culture, doesn't happen overnight. Such patience with and love toward each other is needed. Such patience with and love toward each other. Listen to your life. Don't bite that hook. Remember the four R's: recognize, reframe, relax, and resolve. Choose a new story. Then listen to each other's stories. Sometimes we don't know we have a story until someone is listening. Let our Unitarian Universalist congregations, yours and mine, be places where we hear each other's stories, where we listen for the deeper, ultimate, even sacred meanings in the stories we tell. As in the anthem sung so beautifully by the choir immediately before the sermon began, written by the Unitarian Universalist minister Fred Small, we are and we have been telling new stories, new kinds of love stories in our culture. We have been listening for the meaning in those stories, the stories of same-sex couples who for so long have not been able to reveal their stories. We are and we have been listening to those stories, changing our laws to allow them full and equal expression, and celebrating their sacred meaning. Then listen to each other's stories. Sometimes we don't know we have a story until someone is listening. Let this be a place where we hear each other's stories, where we listen for the deeper, ultimate, even sacred meaning in the stories we all have to tell. And let us tell most of all the stories that make change possible, so that with humility, we gain wisdom